DA's very strong response, the immediate indictment for murder, not to mention the mayor backing him up.
Well, one, the mayor had the same problem in 2001 when he was chair of law and public safety, and that's when the eruption spilled into the streets of Cincinnati, Ohio. Part of his language, too, African Americans in the city of Cincinnati have had a terrible relationship with the prosecutor, Joe Dieters. So we are waiting for a conviction. We're not in celebratory mode. Officer Tasing has bonded himself out. The family is very worried about that, and so is the community. So we're waiting on a conviction.
Iris Rowley, we hope to speak to you again next week. Longtime police accountability activist with the Cincinnati Black United Front. That does it for our broadcast. A fond farewell to our cameraman, Jose Miranda. All the best to you, Jose. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Thanks so much.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn from Henry Ford College. We're live now in the studios with our local public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal, the last edition for July 2015, because today is July 31st, 2015. Hello, I am your host. Thank you for listening to the show, because it's going to be a great show today. Got all kinds of stories about what's happening locally and what matters to us most locally, because after all, what matters to us most is right next door. This is the new WHFR Journal, not the same as last week. Local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. So it's July 31st, and the blue moon happens tonight. I was listening to several sources and looked some things up on this. It's not a holiday as such, folks, but it is an unusual, well, not unusual, but it's an infrequent occurrence astronomically. It's an additional full moon that appears in a subdivision of a year, either the third of four full moons in a season or a second full moon in a month of the common calendar. And that's what happens this month. And of course, 31 days, got a couple extra days there to play around with. This month, we had a full moon on July 2nd and July 31st again tonight. So here's the information about that. The phrase actually has nothing to do with the actual color of the moon, although a literal blue moon, the moon appearing with a tinge of blue, may occur in certain atmospheric conditions. For example, when there's volcanic eruptions or when exceptionally large fires leave particles in the atmosphere. They know there was definitely a blue moon in 1883 when the supervolcano at Krakatoa in the South Pacific let go. For example, that's an extreme example, but you can look at the full moon tonight and see if there's any tint of that blueness, and it means either volcanic eruption or large fires. So we hope it's not blue. In any event, the issue I wanted to bring up is that blue moon has another occurrence. It's since it's kind of a rarity of an event, the term blue moon is used colloquially to mean a rare event, as in a phrase, once in a blue moon. Is that common anymore? I guess some people might still remember that. There were some songs written about it, I think, and that phrase goes back hundreds of years, too. Folklore named each of the full moons in a year according to the time of year. The occasional 13th full moon that came too early for its season was called the blue moon, so the rest of the moons that year retained their customary seasonal names. So, again, the term has been around for quite a while, although the term blue for it hundreds of years ago replaced a no longer understood bleu, which means to betray. The original meaning would have then been betrayer moon, referring to a full moon that would normally, in years without an intercalary month, be the full moon of spring, while in an intercalendary year, it was traitorous in the sense that people would have had to continue fasting for another month in accordance with the season of Lent. So that's a pretty long fast. Yeah. The earliest recorded English usage of the term blue moon is found in an anti-clerical pamphlet attacking the Roman clergy, and Cardinal Thomas Wolsey in particular, by two converted Greenwich friars in England, says folks, William Roy and Jerome Barlow. They published in 1528 under the title Read Me and Not Wroth. It's Middle English. For I say no thinga but trotha. The relevant passage reads, O church of men, thy are wily foxes, if they say the moon is blue, we must believe that it is true, admitting their interpretation. Aha. Well, I just happened, and this is coincidence, so that's why I guess I even brought this up today, too. I was binge watching. A TV series from about 10 years ago called Crossing Jordan. And a really, really excellent dramatic series. Started off a little rough in the first year, but very dramatic and very well done. And they have an episode entitled Blue Moon. And it was the episode I just happened to watch last night. And it was a time in that episode, it was an excuse in the drama for somewhat strange and unusual things. Three or four different plot lines coming together, and a lot of different things happen at the same time that you wouldn't expect, or weren't expected anyway. So that's why I thought I'd bring this up. Also today, and this was on public radio, they did a story about it, National Public Radio, and on WDET, and from via WDET in Detroit. And they ended with the phrase is that, this is more astrological than astronomical, if you know what I mean. Astrology is like, you know, reading futures and the stars and the position of the planets and so on. Okay. Well, they said, and this is National Public Radio, oh my God, that today is a time, or tonight especially, a time for risk-taking. A time, although they put a positive spin on it, for positive risk. So you don't want to jump off a building or get drunk and drive or things that obviously will probably end badly. It's a time for positive risk. So there you are. But so I looked like crazy on the internet for, at least 3 minutes, and that's not enough time to find anything, of course, really. And I went into folklore and all kinds of things. And other than this reference that it's kind of a, originally maybe it was a traitorous kind of image, this blue moon or this extra moon. and certainly it's infrequent. But I didn't get this idea anywhere. And I guess I didn't go to the right astrology website. I didn't get the idea anywhere that it was a risky day or a time to initiate positive risk. So in case you turn into NPR, you know, ask them where they got that, you know, from, because even on their website, there was a story, but it didn't end with this conclusion, it's a time for positive risk. So be very wary of the media, including me. I small local radio station, but you know, I get my sources from others, and I have to say, because I do think about the sources and I critique them, don't I? There's something wrong with that idea about today being a time for positive risk. I wouldn't recommend it. Okay. Always trying new things. Change is really the fact. There's always change, and we have to roll with the punches, as they say, go with the flow, and that means we have to be creative, and we have to, well, think ahead a little bit about consequences. But it's great if we can be the director of the change. You know what I'm saying? If something is coming, we can direct that change into having a positive outcome in some way. Sort of like preparing for a storm. Okay, if you see a storm coming, what can you do to get ready for it so that if it does cause damage of some sort or upset of some sort, it'll be lessened or you'll be ready to quickly resolve the problem. Okay, that's my Blue Moon report. Hey, any other station in Detroit doing something like that for 10 minutes? I don't think so. It's WHFR.FM, the station making waves. So I'm turning now, as he turns away from the microphone and then comes back, I've got to grab my newspapers, to the papers from this last week. Just going to do a couple headlines of stories there. And we're talking about the Dearborn Press and Guide and the Dearborn Times-Herald. But I also have more sources than this coming up later. We had a question that we raised here on the show, I think last week or in the week before, what to do with former Mayor Orville Hubbard's statue, which is in the park area near the old City Hall. And the plan is pretty definite here. They're going to relocate the War Memorial, which is at the southwest corner of Michigan Avenue and Schaefer Road, outside the former City Hall. So it'll be moved to become part of a new Veterans Park. Okay, and the plan is to relocate it by next Memorial Day, May 30th, onto the campus, they call it a campus, of Henry Ford Centennial Library. So not at the new City Hall, maybe they don't have enough room, but it's going to be on the campus of Henry Ford Centennial Library. Both the city and Dearborn Allied War Veterans Council worked together to create the War Memorial in 1991, and 24 years later, they're working together again to find an appropriate new home. While the War Memorial has a focus on the soldiers who have lost their lives in recent major conflicts, with the Veterans Park, they want to acknowledge all the soldiers who have served in the military. Most recently, the city has hired Newman Smith Architecture Firm to design the Veterans Park. They were selected in June, and its contract was signed during the first full week of July. So I guess maybe the monoliths, if I may call them that, the slabs are going to be positioned maybe somewhat differently. In any event, this is costing a little bit of money for the city. But by the way, they say that this plan will probably also located in the area where a fountain is currently in front of the library. That's where the Veterans Park is going to go. This fountain has been inoperative for some time, will almost certainly be demolished as part of the project. Everything is proceeding quickly now on plan, because that's right in the front, exactly in the front. That is the north side, when I say the front, the north side of our Centennial Library here in Dearborn. And so that takes that issue away, because some people were still fighting to get that fountain working again, even though it was costing us $20,000 a year. Although the fountain initially cost a donor to the city $100,000 a year, and the city sort of promised to maintain it from then on, I guess not knowing what cost or entailed in the upkeep of a $100,000 fountain. And so everything is proceeding quickly. The city is giving 100% backing. And the Veterans Park is being financed with money given to the city by Severstal Dearborn, if you remember, since being acquired by AK Steel. Steel Company gave more than $8 million, the majority of which was used to help move city operations into the Dearborn Administrative Center. About $1 million remains set aside for the Veterans Park. The city is paying Newman Smith $100,000 for architecture and engineering services. I guess, out of that $100,000. At the center of the current War Memorial is that 20-foot flagpole surrounded by four 7.5-foot-tall granite monoliths. Yes, they are called monoliths. Each monolith represents a major American conflict. Although there's been a lot more than just four, folks. But anyway, depends what you mean by major, I guess. And the story is somewhat inclusive, and that's good. But they say nothing about Mayor Hubbard, and his statue is not part of the Memorial Veterans Memorial Park originally, but pretty close by. I think it was on the northeast corner of the old City Hall there, very close to Memorial Park. Maybe I'm wrong where it's currently located. But it's going to have to move too, I would assume, unless ArtSpace is going to keep it as some sort of part of the historic building. External statues could be part of the building, I guess. So we still don't have any word on what they're going to do with Orville Hubbard's statue. But they do have big plans, it seems, for the Veterans Memorial moving, and they're well on their way, and it's going to happen. And yet, it's going to be on that north side of the library where the fountain, the defunct fountain, is now located. Interesting, huh? Yeah, that's why you listen to the new WHFR Journal. Tell all your friends, either Friday, 1 to 2 o'clock live, or, yep, you can listen to our directly from our website, whfr.fm, via your desktop computer or your tablet or your smartphone. Yep, you can get us any way, live stream on any of those kinds of devices. By the way, next week, you can actually see us live in person. Oh, my goodness. Our news, WHFR news director, John Connolly, is off in local activities this week. He's very busy supporting a lot of different community activities, and he'll be back with me, and we'll have some special guests, too, as we find them wandering around Dearborn Homecoming next week, Friday, from 1 to 2 o'clock. We'll be live from our WHFR tent, which is going to be just immediately south of the bridge that goes to Dearborn's Ford Field. We're right across from the, well, sort of the northwest corner, bring your compass with you, of the carnival area, as we were last year, too, if you remember where we were last year. So we'll be broadcasting the entire Journal show live from Dearborn Homecoming. That's makes me thirsty even thinking about that, but that's what's going to be happening. And at Homecoming, mentioning Homecoming, free canoeing is a new activity this year, along with all the other things that you know and love, from free music entertainment to, of course, carnival rides and food for small fees, and things for the kids to do for free. But lovers of the outdoor will be happy to hear that free canoeing and other river-related activities will be offered at this year's Homecoming Festival. Canoes will be available from noon to 8 p.m. August 8th and 9th. That's only Saturday and Sunday at the pond in Ford Field Park. I didn't know there was a pond in Ford Field Park. I mean, the field. Is it down on the field? I think there's a pond behind where our tent is, in fact, where they used to do fishing in past years. It's still considered the park. I mean, it's all the park, right? But I think that's where they are. It's just, if you go north on Monroe Street from Michigan Avenue in West Dearborn, Monroe runs right into Ford Field, Dearborn's Ford Field Park. And the sidewalk ends pretty much right at WHFR's tent. And just to the left of that sidewalk, as you're coming north, again, bring your compasses, I'd say about 30, 40 yards over, that's where the park is. That's where the pond is, which I haven't looked closely at, but I always see a few kids over that way. This is interesting, of course. Well, the city of Dearborn is working to develop the Rouge River into greenway that could eventually include canoeing or kayaking through parts of the city, according to the city. The canoeing activity at Homecoming is meant to draw interest to the idea of recreational activities on the Rouge, a branch of which runs through Ford Field Park and feeds into the pond, as stated by the city of Dearborn. Construction is also underway to connect Ford Field Park via a biking hiking path to the Rouge River Gateway Trail that travels through Hines Drive and runs 17 miles to Northville. That trail, which starts in Dearborn, follows a larger branch of the Rouge River. In addition to the free canoeing, it's going to be free. All right, that should be the lead, folks, but didn't get to that yet. The Dearborn Rotary Club will hold its annual Children's Fishing Derby from 8 to 11 a.m. Saturday at the pond. And the Kiwanis Club of Otter Drive will hold a turbo turtle race on the river at 4:30 p.m. Sunday. WHFR frequently even does a play-by-play of that race. Although it's very difficult because all the plastic turtles look pretty much the same, except they've got a number on them, but I'm not sure we can see the number from the riverbank. Anyway, We do it. Somehow, we do it. The amazing is only a little bit more difficult for WHFR. Uh-huh. The Homecoming Festival, of course, is going to run from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. each day and will feature free entertainment, kids' activities, reunions, and a variety of food. Fireworks show on Saturday and Sunday nights only. Its presenting sponsor, that is its major sponsor, is Oakwood Healthcare, a part of Beaumont Health. For more information, you can go to cityofdearborn.org. Yes, you can. Oh, I see we have a phone call coming in the studio, and if that's one of our listeners, I'm sorry I can't answer the phone now, because there's no one else here but me right now. Sorry. But always popular here at WHFR. Maybe they'll call back after 2 o'clock. Okay. Let's see. Let's go to the Times Herald from this last Wednesday, July 29th. Michigan by rail presents coast-to-coast plan. All three proposals passed through Dearborn. Well, when I read the headline, I thought, oh boy, we can go from New York City to Los Angeles, you know, and it'll all come through Dearborn, which is hard to imagine because that's not a straight line from New York or a straight line to L.A., but that's coast to coast. That, to me, that's what it means. But no, the article actually talks about from our eastern coast of Michigan on the lakes to our western coast of Michigan on Lake Michigan. It's the first time ever I've heard of coast to coast being referred to in terms of Michigan. Although the guy that gave this presentation, our own Barry Murray of the City of Dearborn, Director of Economic Community Development, maybe he didn't do the PowerPoint presentation, but the picture in the paper shows the sign behind him. Projected from a computer, probably. The slide says coast-to-coast passenger rail study. So it's very impressive that we have coasts. But I have to look up that definition because I don't think we do have coasts. Okay, but anyway. the idea is that these new stops are going to be included from Dearborn to Ann Arbor, Howell, Jackson, Lansing, and then Grand Rapids. So it's going to go that direction. I know I'm part of a group of people who would like to see go up to Traverse City instead, or in addition. But, and I didn't realize this, even though I'm old enough to know, we did have passenger rail service between Detroit, Lansing, and Grand Rapids, but that ended in 1971. So I would guess one reason it's easier to do that is that the railways or the right-of-way for the trains, that land is still owned by Amtrak. And they just have to perhaps fix up and upgrade the actual rail parts, you know, the metal rails and the whatever you call those wooden timbers underneath the foundation. Probably. The study that will also explore the high-speed passenger rail possibility, and Dearborn's already preparing for that with our second rail, special grade crossing signals. So we're ready for the 110-mile-an-hour trains. It's just that they can't run those trains to get here, but when they do get here, we'll be ready for them. So that was a great meeting. I didn't get to it. It was at the John D. Dingell Transit Center, of course, right here in Dearborn, back on July 23rd. And their main speaker was Michigan Environmental Council Policy Associate Elizabeth Trettel, or Trettel. So, anyway, all the three routes they're looking at as the first step in that are going to pass through Dearborn. We will be connected. Oh, boy, oh, boy. Interesting story from the Traverse City, just mentioning Traverse City, Record Eagle, which is one of the papers in Traverse City, that is partners somehow to the local Dearborn Times Herald. It says, what this country needs is a good $500 apartment. That's a guest editorial. I'm all for that. And they said, hey, the heating and cooling costs shouldn't be no more than $50 a month. And they go on to say, better yet, include the utilities in the $500. They say safe housing at that price would fill instantly. A single person working 40 hours a week earning the current minimum wage of $8.15 an hour grosses $1,304 a month. That's gross before they take out the taxes, or about $15,000 a year. Excuse me. So after taxes, that's about $1,000 a month. An apartment priced at $500 a month would consume roughly half of that. That's not ideal. It would be a giant step up for many who now barely survive paying rent of $700 or more. So who would foot the bill for that? But they think that maybe instead of raising the minimum wage, maybe there can be some government subsidies, I think they're suggesting this, for low-income housing, for just this amount. And I happen to agree. I think that's a really, really excellent idea. It's sort of just, it's a different point of view on the whole minimum wage issue. Since housing is so vital and so important, to have safe housing and relatively good quality housing too, you know, where the water works and so on, that would really help people. I'm not saying the minimum wage should stay the minimum wage. I don't have a position on that. I've heard statements both ways. One side, of course, says primarily that if you raise the minimum wage, then those businesses that have to pay the higher money will raise their prices for their products or services. Yeah, but we're giving all those people more money to live well and to spend their money to help the economy. That's the flip-flop on this, folks. But of course, I also feel most businesses, larger businesses certainly, like McDonald's, are making such huge profits they can easily afford it. I thought when businesses made a lot of money, they started paying their employees, their trusted, valued employees, better. Yeah, just show me where that happens. Show me how many times that happens in our country. Yeah, almost never. Almost never does that story ever come up. And I'm sure any company that does it would want to share that story. But it doesn't. The public is invited to August 4th. I think I mentioned this last week, but I'll just mention it again. It's coming up next Tuesday here in Dearborn from 5 to 8 p.m. There'll be an open house at the new building, new City Hall, which is called the Dearborn Administrative Center, 16901 Michigan Avenue, from 5 to 8 p.m. But either to distract you from the open house or, and I'm sorry, I'm being somewhat strangely critical about this, they're also using the National Crime Night Out, Night Out for Crime, Night Out on Crime is the full title of it, that is sponsored by our police department. And so in the parking lot of the DAC, they're going to have free food and all kinds of fun activities. They will have all their Ford police vehicles, their SWAT team vehicles and equipment, their bomb squad vehicle, their police bicycle patrol, and the canine unit. They're going to be extracting, or showing you how they might extract, dead bodies from crushed up cars with their Jaws of Life tools. Now, they'll also have information about crime prevention and Neighborhood Watch and take-home child identification kits and all information about NICSL, which is their way to sign up to get emergency messages directly to your computer or smartphone from the police department, you know, in short time span there. And they'll also have the Wayne County Sheriff Mounted Unit. We'll have some horsies there with police officers on them. Oh, my gosh. Someone said to me, after I explained all this was happening and it's like the full police department equipment is going to be out there from 5 to 8. Wouldn't that be a great time to do some crime somewhere else in Dearborn? Yeah. I think they're probably got some extra officers ready to meet the needs, but it sure sounds like they've got all the real, real serious, including the bomb squad, real serious police force out there from 5 to 8 this Tuesday. But you'll be very safe. You'll be very safe. And if anybody causes trouble during their tour of the Dearborn Administrative Center, like somebody forcibly trying to get into the second floor that is closed and that nobody will say what they're using it for, if anything, and why not, they'll be escorted out by a full team of police, because they'll have the full team of police of every sort there. So, and the food, free hot dogs, chips, and ice cream. Some sort of contest, too. And music, too. Did I mention music? Music. It almost feels like, you know, like they don't think anybody would come to the open house, because who'd want to see the new building that the city had to pay $12 million plus for? You know, who'd want to see that? So we got to have something else for people to do. And this national night out on crime just happened to be the same day, I guess. So, hey, let's put the two together. And then maybe nobody will even have to go inside to see how small and inadequate some of the facilities are. Things like, oh, come and see the council chambers. It's only a small multi-purpose room, not too much bigger than an average classroom at Henry Ford College. You know, nothing pretty, nothing beautiful, just individual stacking chairs that they slide into place. But hey, it's only city council. Who needs pomp and circumstance, right? Sure. So, you know, anybody that's a little bit negative about the new city hall is probably not going to go see it anyway. But since taxpayers did foot the bill for this building and this move, let's go see all of its features. And they're in, but I've been in it briefly in certain areas, but I don't think you're going to be too impressed by what you see. The question is what you don't see, I think, and what they're going to do with it in the future. And that just hasn't been figured out yet. So anyway, 5 to 8 at the Dearborn Administrative Center. Next week, Tuesday, August 4th. And you can also somehow participate in the National Night Out on Crime. Oh, and a little recommendation by the police department is, in honor of the National Night Out on Crime, they're saying leave your porch lights on all night. I guess that defers crime. How many watts of electricity are used for that purpose? And we're continuing to look through. It's half past the hour, and the new WHFR Journal, continuing to look through the papers here. Henry Ford College is going to begin next week with a presentation of A Raisin in the Sun. This is a classic play, and written by one of the great African-American playwrights, Lorraine Hansberry. And it's going to be at 8 p.m., August 6th to 8th and 13th to 15th. So it's going to run just 2 weeks, two weekends, and 2 p.m. on the Sundays, August 9th and 16th. So it starts next week, Friday, Saturday. And then that's at 8 p.m. and 2 p.m. on Sunday the 9th, and then the same the following weekend. So if you're busy with homecoming, you can come the following weekend. It's held at the play is being performed in our Adrie Auditorium on the main campus of Henry Ford College. The building is called the McKenzie Fine Arts Center. Let's see. Do you know the story? Well, it's classic. It's often taught in colleges even as a play to read and study. Very significant social drama. When an African-American family living in poverty in Chicago receives a windfall insurance check, the family chooses to spend some of the money to move to an all-white neighborhood. The show debuted on Broadway in 1959, and it was a turning point in American theater at a time when audiences were predominantly white. It was also the first Broadway play written by an African-American woman. Director Christopher Bremer says who's been an award winner himself in the Detroit area and many different venues. His work is considered one of the best work by any local director. And he said he feels that A Raisin in the Sun ranks among the 100 best plays, and that Hansberry had amazing insight into the human condition as well as the future direction of African-American culture before the Civil Rights Movement began. I'm sure former Mayor Orville Hubbard, it was one of his favorite plays too, of course. What did he mean by that? Okay, so that's the top stories from the News Herald. And last but not least, in terms of the physical papers in front of me here, is the Wednesday edition of the Dearborn Press and Guide. Then we'll get into the internet stories that are also usually a little more current, too. Let's see if I found anything in here. They repeat a lot of the stories that they had in their Sunday paper. Isn't that amazing? I've always loved it when they also talk about road work, about certain roads being closed, like Greenfield between 94 and Rotunda Drive, which is nearby where I live, and that I encountered this morning. I encountered it a week ago, folks. So thanks for putting the paper today. But just in case, you know, somebody doesn't realize that that's happening, and they just decide to happen to drive down Greenfield Road, you know, they might have a little problem there. It slows down to just one lane. So there is some road repair happening, and I will say that in my area, we've got some of the worst side streets. I never thought Greenfield was in that bad of trouble, but that's taken care of by different people, so I think. So we'll see how that works out. Let's see. Yep, that's it for the physical papers. You're listening to a new WHFR Journal. And here's a couple stories so that I can drink a beverage from Michigan Radio. And this is one from just updated just 5 hours ago. Michigan schools continue to struggle under emergency financial management. Listen up here.
With the Michigan Public Radio Network, I'm Jake Neer. It's been almost 2.5 years since Michigan's revamped emergency manager law took effect. 13 Michigan cities and 5 school districts are currently under some form of state oversight, and there are growing doubts about the law's ability to help schools in financial distress. Regardless of your thoughts about the idea of the state appointing unelected officials to take control over cities and schools, it's fair to say there have been some successes on the municipal front. 7 cities are now transitioning back to full local control. Only 1 municipal emergency manager remains on the job. The same cannot be said about schools. Only 1 district has ever exited state receivership and stayed out from under it. That district, Inkster Public Schools, has since been dissolved due to financial troubles. For people living in Highland Park, failure to stabilize enrollment under a number of EMs means their only high school will not be opening its doors in the fall. Outside Highland Park Renaissance Academy, I run into Keith.
What were you here to do?
I'm trying to get some transcripts.
Seems like a lot of people are here to get transcripts today and no one can get in.
Yeah, so that's what it was. We're trying to get transcripts for the kids.
Is the goal to get transcripts to transfer students?
To another school, yes.
Is that because the school's closing?
Yes, it is. That's it.
Keith wouldn't give his last name because he didn't want to be dragged into the debate. He and several others, all hoping to get student transcripts, say they checked with the district to make sure the building would be open that day. Keith says losing the high school is a blow to the community.
If we ain't got no school, how are we going to get the kids to progress or go anywhere? And especially if you got to go clean across town now to take them. Now people got to figure out a way to get them there, get them back.
Democratic State Senator Bert Johnson represents Highland Park, Hamtramck, and parts of Detroit. That means he's likely dealt with more emergency managers than any other state elected official other than the governor. And he says he's had good working relationships with many of them.
I mean, listen, at the end of the day, they're people just like I am. They put on their pants the same way that I do. So I recognize that they're not monsters and they're doing a job. I also recognize that in a lot of instances, they're not equipped to do the job that they're being brought in to do.
Johnson says he believes the state has a responsibility to assist public schools that fall into financial trouble. But he says the emergency manager approach has not worked.
You can't bring in bean counters and think that they're going to take care of the academic side of schooling. And schooling is much, much different than running a municipality. Once you lose a child in the education system, you hardly get them back.
And there are signs from Governor Rick Snyder's administration that confidence has dropped, at least in some cases, in the ability of emergency managers to deal with schools in financial emergencies. Snyder hopes to sell lawmakers on a major restructuring and bailout of Detroit public schools, which has had 4 EMs in 7 years. Michigan Department of Treasury spokesperson Terry Stanton says it's relatively easy for parents to move kids to different schools. That means it can be very hard to stop the bleeding once enrollment begins to drop.
When you have a declining enrollment, just because an emergency manager is appointed doesn't mean that enrollment stabilizes immediately or that there's additional student growth.
Stanton points out that out of about 600 school districts in Michigan, only five are under some form of state oversight. But he says the administration and lawmakers are trying to be proactive. He points to a set of new laws that create a so-called early warning system for schools. They require added financial reports for districts that show signs of financial trouble. They would make it easier for intermediate school districts and the state to intervene early on.
The longer you let a problem fester and grow, then the more difficult the hole gets to dig out of, and the more difficult the decisions are to remedy that situation.
But Democrats, like Senator Johnson, oppose the measures in the legislature, in part because the new laws also make it easier for the state to appoint emergency managers if schools don't fully comply. For the Michigan Public Radio Network, I'm Jake Neer in Highland Park.
This is WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Jay Koronek with you. There's also a follow-up story that I saw just happened just yesterday. But here is Jack Lessenberry's column from this week's Metro Times. He is, of course, a professor of telecom down at Wayne State University and part of Michigan Public Radio himself in Ann Arbor. He says, warning, this column may give you nightmares. And it very well should. He uses an obscenity there, and I won't because I can't. But he goes on to say, okay, here goes. Did you know that every day up to 540,000 barrels of oil and propane are pumped through two steel pipes lying at the bottom of the Straits of Mackinac? That's roughly the line between Lake Huron and Michigan. Those pipes, which are protected by nothing, snake on for 4.5 miles underwater, as much as 270 feet below the surface. Down there, 23 million gallons of pressurized oil is roaring through them every day. Nobody would dispute that there is no more important resource in this part of the world than the Great Lakes. They hold 84% of all the fresh water in North America. You don't even want to think about what might happen if those pipes were to rupture and millions of gallons of oil were pumped into the lakes before anyone could do anything about it. Mess the Great Lakes up, and you're looking at the mother of all environmental disasters and the distinct possibility that life in these parts would no longer be nearly as worth living. Now think about this. Those pipelines, which are owned and operated by a Canadian firm called Enbridge, were on the bottom of the lakes, carrying all that oil the day President Obama was born. In fact, they've been there for 62 years. If they were human, they would be eligible for Social Security. So far, they haven't cracked or corroded enough to rupture, but all it would take is once. How safe are they? We have no idea, because the company refuses to tell us. Enbridge says that they're safe. They say they're inspected mechanically and tested for signs of corrosion inside and out. But they won't share the results of those tests. Not with us, and not fully even with the state. Earlier this month, the Michigan Petroleum Pipeline Task Force released its report on the pipeline. The task force was chaired by State Attorney General Bill Schulte, who never misses a chance to pander to the far right, and Dan Wyatt, who is Rick Snyder's director of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, also known as MDEQ. So, as Jack Lessenberry continues, no flaming radicals here, but even they seemed plainly irked by Enbridge. While the task force suggested reforms were tepid at best, they did call for the legislature to require Enbridge to disclose its safety inspection records. Lots of luck with that, given the nature of our elected bozos and the power of company lobbyists. Schulte did note that building a pipeline under the straits would never be allowed today. He called for Enbridge to replace it after what the attorney general said would be a, quote, short duration, unquote. But guess what? Enbridge isn't going to do that unless forced to. Finding a replacement would cost a lot, and the company wants us to accept its assurances that the pipeline is safe. We shouldn't accept that as good enough from anyone, but especially not Enbridge. Nor now for the part that should really ruin your sleep. 5 years ago this week, on July 25th, 2010, another Enbridge pipeline, one that was only 40 years old, ruptured in the Kalamazoo River near Marshall, Michigan. This sent more than 1 million gallons of heavy crude oil into the water. This was on a Sunday evening. It was 18 hours before the company figured out what was happening. Alarms did go off when the pipeline ruptured, but idiot workers, continued on the back here, thought it meant that the pipeline was blocked, so they increased the pressure, sending even more crude into the river. The mess took 4 years to clean up. 25 miles of river was heavily contaminated. 35 miles were closed to recreational boating for 2 years. The company first said the cleanup would cost $5 million. But the total bill was well over $1.2 billion. The cleanup will never really be complete. There will always be some residual oil. What caused the pipe to break? According to the National Transportation Safety Board study and report, corrosion fatigue in the pipes, the same thing people most worry about when it comes to the pipeline beneath the straits. The head of the NTSB at the time heavily criticized Enbridge's incompetent handling of the disaster, comparing it to the Keystone Cops. That's in the silent film days, 1910s. Wacky group of so-called policemen causing more trouble than what there was originally and not solving any problems. Very funny, of course. Enbridge finally agreed to pay Michigan a $75 million fine. Of course, the cleanup cost $1.2 billion. If anything like that happened to the pipeline beneath the straits, it would make the Kalamazoo River disaster look like a little ink spilled in the bathtub. True, the Straits pipeline doesn't carry the heavy crude and tar sands oil that the Kalamazoo one did. But how would you clean up two lakes polluted by who knows how many million gallons if the pipeline were to break? You couldn't. The government needs to step up to Enbridge and give them an ultimatum and a timeline for closing the pipeline. Otherwise, well, there are those who think this country puts profits before people, maybe before life itself. Waiting for the lakes to be destroyed would be a pretty conclusive way to do it. And the follow-up on that from Michigan Public Radio yesterday indicated that dozens of protesters rallied at the state capitol against an aging pipeline under the Straits of Mackinac. The group delivered a letter addressed to Rick Snyder and Attorney General Bill Schulte demanding that the pipeline be shut down. Mariah Ureta, Michigan organizer for the group Food and Water Watch, said, "This pipeline is already one pinhole leak away from wreaking havoc upon the Great Lakes. The Straits of Mackinac is the worst possible place for an oil spill to occur." So I wonder, was it Jack Lessenberry's editorial in Metro Times on Wednesday that, no, they had to plan this in advance of that. But so some people are speaking up and showing up for protests that matter. Well, there's a lot going on this weekend, at least downriver. A couple things happening that we'll mention in a minute or two. But I wanted to mention next weekend a couple things, because we'll be right on top of next weekend when we're at homecoming and maybe distracted by homecoming-type stories next Friday. Dearborn Heights citywide is going to have a garage sale August 8th, and that's going to be at the Canfield Community Center from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., That's on Beach Daily Road between Cherry Hill and Ford Roads. More than 150 vendors are expected to be there selling new and used items or to swap with buyers. The cost for resident vendors is $25 and $35 for non-residents. Admission for shoppers and visitors is free. So that's a pretty huge garage sale, all in that one location, Canfield Community Center, and that'll be next week, Saturday, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. But Thursday, August 6th is the 70th anniversary of the tragic bombing of the city of Hiroshima, Japan. And the date is being remembered by a service and a demonstration locally organized by Peace Action of Michigan. The commemoration will be held at St. John's Episcopal Church, located at the southeast corner of Woodward and 11 Mile. Woodward and 11 Mile Road. Not far from Beaumont Hospital, by the way. And parking is available on the east side of the church. They'll begin at 6 p.m. next Thursday, August 6th. Outside, to wave goodbye to nuclear weapons. So they're going to have signs, and they're going to be holding up large signs so passing motorists will understand our message. At 7 p.m., our program will begin in the lower level of the church, which I think is the bomb shelter, isn't it? The lower level? Our speaker is Francis Fran Shore, Director of Public Education and Community Engagement, which the acronym is PEACE, by the way, the PEACE Project, and Emeritus Professor of History at Wayne State University. I should also mention that, as they do every year, the Michigan Peace Action of Michigan, who've been on the show, and I've had them in, talked to them, they are doing a little field trip over the weekend. They're going to be leaving Oak Park, Michigan on Friday, August 7th, for the August 8th action at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Because you see, Oak Ridge, Tennessee just received permission from the federal government, if you can believe this, to start a new uranium production facility there with a capacity of 80 new nuclear warheads per year. Because, you know, you don't just want to have old nuclear warheads. And I think we have something like, is it 500 times the number of nuclear warheads that are needed to destroy this planet, to rip it asunder? Let's get it right. I get all choked up when I think about all the nuclear bombs in the world today, and we've got most of them. And they're going to build 80 new ones every year? So they've got transportation they're working out from through Peace Action of Michigan. And you can, first of all, they're charging $80 per seat with offers for partial or full scholarships, depending on other people donating money. If you have a van or a car and can drive to Tennessee, please contact Tim Bergier. And she's got an email address. The number 2, MISTNBC. Number 2, MIST, MISTNBC, at gmail.com. I'm sure you can just look up Peace Action of Michigan. They have a website, and they'll have information about this. They're coming back on Sunday, so you'll miss homecoming. Oh my gosh, did I say you should miss homecoming? If you want to, this is important. This is something that could end the world. Okay, we just got done talking about how life as we know it will end in Michigan if that pipeline ruptures across the Mackinac Straits. That'll be bad enough for us here in Michigan. But the whole world, including Michigan, of course, if we get into a nuclear confrontation or too much uranium sitting around in pools, cooling pools in Canada or elsewhere, that can also, you know, cause destruction, and it'll poison us slowly over the next couple hundred thousand years. So it'll be the end of people on this planet. So we don't need any more bombs. We don't need any more mining for uranium either. Because what are you going to do it after you get it? Build a bomb. You know, oh, we need energy production. Not that way. No, we don't. Solar and wind power is all we need. We just have to move to that. Just have to make the decision. Okay. Not wanting to end on a downer too much for today's show. We're going to end a little early, play some more spinners for you to get you in the Dearborn homecoming mood for next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And remember, WHFR will be out there at our tent and broadcasting reports from 11 in the morning to 8 o'clock every night. Come on by and visit us, and we have our annual Purge record sale and our logo items for a small donation, too, and I think you'll have fun coming by and checking in with us. And, of course, the Journal will be live next Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. at Dearborn Homecoming. Other things to do this weekend, Melvindale's 4th Annual Street Fair will take place this Saturday and Sunday from 10 to 10, Oakwood Boulevard and Allen Road. And the 20th Annual Jazz on the River takes over Elizabeth Park in Trenton this weekend, August 1st to 2nd. It's the 20th anniversary. They're going to have renowned saxophonist Kenny G and singer Jeffrey Osborne. It's a free event, but $5 donations are suggested for parking. The park opens at noon each day for the event. Molly's Sports Grill and Bar holding its official 10th year anniversary party with games and events for everybody. That's 19400 North Line Road. Henry Ford Healthcare Brownstone Township. There's going to be a health fair there tomorrow from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. That's at 23050 West Road. Free blood pressure checks, dental screenings, low-cost physicals, and much more. Oh, that's it for today. This is WHFR.FM, the station, making waves. Thank you for listening, and tune back in next Friday, or come on out to Homecoming and be there and stare at us while we try to do the news next week. Thank you for listening. Take care out there.